Cosmic Shed.
You're listening to The Cosmic Shed, a show that explores the way science and storytelling collide.
We'll be talking about films, books, music, theatre, TV, and anything else that catches our curiosity. From rigorously accurate science fact to ridiculously speculative science fiction.
We don't want to nitpick, but to celebrate the ways science and art can complement and enrich each other.
Mostly, we just want to talk about nerdy things that make us happy.
We've decided to do all of this from a crumbling garden shed somewhere in suburban Bristol.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between. Hello and welcome to The Cosmic Shed. It's actually just me, Andrew, in the shed at the moment because I have to bring you some slightly sad news about the shed before we get on with the podcast proper. Well, it's been pretty windy here in Bristol over recent weeks, and one particular storm, Storm Imogen, hit the shed quite hard. The shed no longer has a door, and the roof is no longer waterproof, and the insides of the shed have become quite wet and quite mouldy. And you'll appreciate that that's a large part of the reason why we haven't had any episodes out recently, and we do apologise for that. Obviously we'd like to do some more, and the shed is coming back to life very soon. But before that, this is the last episode that we recorded before the winds hit, and it's all about Contact, the Carl Sagan book and the film of the same name, directed by Robert Zemeckis. And we're so excited to say that we actually have an interview with Jill Tarter of SETI. With me in the shed that day were
Maddie
and
Steve
and
Ty Singh from Bristol Bad Film Club and Bristol Sunset Cinema.
Hang on a second. Contact isn't a bad film.
It's not a bad film. It's a great film. I'm just a massive science fiction nerd.
Sorry you can't see very much.
I like it.
Your eyes will get used to it.
It's the cosmic shed. It's got to be dark and mysterious.
What is Bristol Bad Film Club?
Well, I've been running it for 2 years now, and it's essentially where we show... I mean, the phrase we use is films so bad they're entertaining, but I like to think we're stretching that out to just films that are really unique in their own strange ways, cult films, just really... films that you can't believe were ever made.
I can vouch for Bristol Bad Film Club. If you see it, if you live in Bristol, if you're in the area, go and seek it out. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And Ty here presents at it. And to be perfectly honest, what happened was he presented and I thought, he's cool. So I asked him if he'd like to be on The Cosmic Shed, and he said...
yes!
And I said, what film would you like to do? And he said...
Contact!
And I said, brilliant, because that's my favourite film. In a quite a childish way, my favourite film and my favourite book.
Written by your favourite man.
Yeah. Unbelievably, there is somebody who thought that it was a good idea to marry me. And when we got married, as part of our ceremony, we actually used some lines, or in fact just one line, from the book of Contact by Carl Sagan. For small creatures such as we, the vastness is bearable only through love. So Contact is a film starring Jodie Foster as Ellie Arroway and a lot of other people, but probably most importantly, Palmer Joss, played by Matthew McConaughey. If you haven't seen the film, or read the book, or heard the audiobook, please go and do so now, because there will be spoilers. Although I have to say, I don't think you can spoil this film or this book. You can know everything about it and still get a huge amount out of it by reading or watching or listening to it. A quick synopsis for those who have seen it but not recently. Jodie Foster plays Ellie Arroway, who is a radio astronomer. She works for SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, using radio telescopes to send, but mostly receive data from the cosmos and look for signals which would suggest that they'd been created by an extraterrestrial intelligence. And of course, they find a signal, they build a machine, and Jodie Foster's character, Ellie Arroway, travels through space to meet an alien species. I did manage to speak to Ben earlier today.
Yay!
And he had a poem for us.
Initially, for this episode, Andrew asked me to write a poem with a rhythm that is somehow based around base 11. I don't know why he did that. And obviously I failed to translate that into a poem. So instead, I have written a poem based around prime numbers. The lines are just prime numbers up to 11, and then it goes down again, back to 1. So yeah, I couldn't make the base 11 work, but I did try and include one of Andrew's favourite moments from Contact the Book. If an ant recorded a message for us and transmitted it over 26 light years, 18 hours of static, at many hundred Janskis, would the result be understood? Or just noise?
Thanks, Ben. One of the reasons that I do this whole Cosmic Shed thing is so that I can meet amazing scientists and people who are involved in films and books and things. And one of the things that very often comes up when we're chatting either side of the interviews is a love for this book and this film. And when I was speaking to Adam Rutherford, we got to talking about Contact.
My youngest daughter is called Juno. My wife came up with that name because it's a nice name. And when she said, "What about Juno?" And I went, "Yeah, it's a nice name. I love that film." And we Googled it. And the first thing that came up after Juno, the film, was the current NASA mission to Jupiter, which is called Juno. And I saw that and said, "Yep, that's her name." And I, for totally spontaneous reasons, her nickname is Sparks, because Juno Sparks sounds quite nice. Jenny Sparks is a superhero. Okay. So I call her Sparks. I'd forgotten that that's what Ellie Arroway's dad calls Ellie. And when that came up on screen, I was like, this is like the planets aligning. So my daughter's called Juno after a rocket and Sparks after Ellie Arroway. I adore Contact. It's a great story. It's beautifully filmed. It's very emotionally engaging. And it's brilliant. The reason it's even better is because the scientific ideas that underlie it are right, interesting. And what do you expect if Carl Sagan is going to write the book that it's based on? I think it's the single best representation of a scientist on screen, because she is driven, hardworking, passionate, constantly hindered by bureaucracy and grant writing, but understands the scientific method. And you see a real person who, very near the beginning of that film, goes and gets drunk and sleeps with a priest. Now, I've never slept with a priest. But I like seeing scientists in their natural environments, that they're not distant or icy or weird boffins. I see what, you know, people like us are like. We're people who are interested in stuff and have devoted our lives to understanding how stuff works. And that's what Contact is.
I think Contact is a beautiful film, not just because of the science in it. I think it's a fantastic story. It's got some really good characters in it. There's lots of human stories. There's lots of opposing perspectives. And even the ones that you might consider a bit more extreme come across really, really well. I can identify with a lot of people in this film.
I felt that the characters were incredibly real and very relatable as actual people. Like Ellie's boss.
David Drumlin.
Mm. Yeah. I feel like in some, I don't know, research environments, bosses are like that, where they'll kind of swoop in and take the exciting stuff away from you, which is not really cool.
No.
But it does happen, and obviously, yeah. And you do really feel her emotions and trauma when he's doing that, and you really get the feeling, her passion is very clearly evident when she's being told that she can't carry on with her research. That ultimately makes it so appealing, because it is human, isn't it? Like, it's not superhumans doing stuff or beating the odds really dramatically. It does come to you, like, if you're struggling with something really randomly, you'll be thinking about it for ages, banging your head against the wall, not knowing what to do, and then you'll, I don't know, like, be out with your friends and suddenly be like, I can do that! Mm. Like, oh my gosh! And then you're itching to go and try it, because you're like, it's really going to make a difference.
Completely. That's definitely how it is in the book.
Mm.
In the book, it's a realistic slog of, like, we've got this, and trying all the different ways, and eventually they work something out.
There are a couple of bits that link in with my experience of science and engineering. Although I must say that I've never had a scientific breakthrough descend to me from a billionaire on a plane travelling around the world. I'm hoping that Elon Musk will land in my garden in his space rocket and dispense wisdom.
He'll take you to Mars with him.
He's slightly less evil than Haddon. Is Haddon evil? Sinister, maybe.
Yeah, he is sinister. And he's totally a creation for the film. He doesn't exist in the book at all.
Right.
Hey.
Yeah.
Interesting. So do they solve the problem themselves in the book?
Yeah, it's more like...
Real life.
Yeah.
That was a weird thing to throw into drama. Yeah. Add to the drama, wasn't it?
One of the other big differences with the book is that it's not just Ellie Arroway that goes to meet...
It's six people, isn't it? It holds six people.
Oh, so is it less of a question that they might be delusional and more of a question they might deliberately be making the whole thing up?
Yeah. Collusion rather than delusion, I suppose.
Okay. Yeah. Hey. You've convinced me. I'm going to read the book.
Yeah, read the book. So
good. Me too.
Ty, have you read the book?
I haven't.
Oh.
I really should. I love Sagan's. I've watched Cosmos and I've read a lot of his stuff online, but I've never actually sat down and read one of his books, which is probably blasphemy considering the company I'm in.
Get out of the shed. I think I've been pretty clear about this, but everybody should read this book or listen to the audiobook. Don't just watch the film. There's one particular section of the book which you really should experience. Ellie is taken on much more of a tour of the universe by the alien in the book and in the audiobook, actually. And you get to go on that journey with her. It's just so magical being taken on a trip through the cosmos with one of its engineers. Because that's who the aliens are, of course. They're the engineers of the universe in contact. And you get to go on a trip with one of them via the imagination and writing of Carl Sagan, and it's not something that you should miss out on. In fact, if you'd like to listen to the audiobook, which is read brilliantly by Jodie Foster, you can download it for free by visiting audibletrial.com/The Cosmic Shed.
This film was in development for a long time at Warner Brothers, and one of the first directors that was going to direct it was George Miller, but before that it was actually going to be Carl Sagan. He wanted to make his first contact movie, had problems doing it, and then went away and wrote the novel, which Warner Brothers then optioned. And the first director to be attached before Robert Zemeckis was George Miller, who most people know from the Mad Max films or Happy Feet. That really depends on your cinematic preferences. And he was actually responsible for casting Jodie Foster in the movie. And he had several other casting choices that didn't pan out, including, I think, Ralph Fiennes was going to be Palmer Joss.
Right.
And Sidney Poitier was going to be the president. This is a version while the president was going to play a key part in the film. And he was actually fired from the production because Warner Brothers were worried about spiraling costs. And there was a problem with the third act, which Robert Zemeckis has gone on record with saying that he wasn't a fan of when he took over the film. I dug around a bit and there were two planned endings that never happened. One is that the first contact scene at the end happens with an extraordinary light show around the planet Earth. Alien beings looking like angels descend and make contact with humanity that way. Which, considering the whole faith aspect of the film, would have been a bit on the nose. But at the same time, you think that's a bit Close Encounters of the Third Kind. But either way, that was dropped. And the second planned ending was that the Earth is essentially swallowed up by a wormhole and transported to another portion of the galaxy where humanity first makes contact with an alien species. Which, from a scientific point of view, you've got to go, hang on, what's happened to the Earth? It's no longer around the sun. Mm. What's happening with the moon? Is everything just going wrong on Earth during this period of first contact?
Yeah, and both of those are massive departures from what actually happened in the book as well.
Massive departures. They would have cost loads from a production point of view and a special effects point of view. So, unsurprisingly, those were dropped for the more low-key ending, but emotionally more impactful.
In the book, the president is a woman. And so Sidney Poitier isn't a woman, and neither is Bill Clinton.
No, not to my knowledge.
He has never been a woman with that. So how did we end up with Bill Clinton in the film?
Well, I mean, the film came out in 1997, and at the time there was that big NASA announcement of what looked like an organism encased in rock. For a while, it looked like we had found extraterrestrial life, albeit encased in a fossilized form. And Bill Clinton did a press conference, and one of the things he said was, "We'll continue to listen closely to what it has to say." And Robert Zemeckis says that when he saw Bill Clinton say this in the press conference and tying it into extraterrestrial life, he was like, "I've got to use this in the film. This is so relevant, and it would make it completely contemporary." And he used the footage, without consulting the White House at all.
Really?
No. Well, they thought, you know, it's in the public domain, it'll be a bit of fun. He just did it, and I think at the time there were a few comments about it, but by and large he got away with it, and it's just cheaper than casting Sidney Poitier as the president.
Yeah. When Carl Sagan was commissioned to write this book, he was given $2 million as an advance.
That was the biggest to date at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah,
which is mad.
And he hadn't written any fiction at all. Mm-hmm. I think that gives you a kind of idea of how popular Carl Sagan was at the time. Yeah. And what a name he must have been to be able to...
The brand.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And as Adam Rutherford said, Carl Sagan based the character of Ellie Arroway on two or three scientists that he knew. And one of those scientists was Jill Tarter. And I asked her how it came about.
I was in Ithaca, New York, at a conference, and Carl came up and said, why don't you come out to the house tonight? We're having a cocktail party. And so I went, and he took me over in the corner, and he said, actually, Anne, his wife, said, Carl's writing a science fiction book. And I said, I know. The New York Times told us how much he got for as an advance last weekend, and we were all terribly jealous. Smiled, and Annie said, well, you may think you recognize someone in the book, but I think you'll like her. I said, oh.
Ellie Arroway is a radio astronomer who works at SETI in the book and the film. And Jill Tarter is a radio astronomer who works at SETI in real life.
I said, okay, look, as long as she doesn't eat ice cream cones for lunch, no one's going to think it's me. Back in the day, we were... located at NASA Ames, and on the base there was a Baskins and Robbins, and that was the best, you know, that was the best lunch. It was going to be an ice cream cone. Also, when Carl sent me a pre-publication copy of the book, I thought that character was amazing. I read it and I said, well, wait, Carl didn't know this about me. How could he know this?
Really?
It was pretty amazing. And then I had years before sent Carl a report from American Association of University Women, a meeting that I'd participated in just after I finished graduate school, which for me was pivotal. There was a bill being introduced into Congress by Ted Kennedy to provide funding for women who had been in the scientific workforce or engineering workforce and had dropped out, stepped back in order to raise a family, and now they wanted to re-enter the workforce, but of course needed a lot of training for catching up with all that had happened in the interim. And to celebrate it, there was a meeting in Washington, D.C., to which I was invited, and this meeting was completely singular in my experience because I walked into a room that was filled with 80 women, 80 smart, really intense and delightful women. Yeah. And the contrast was that I had come out of an engineering school where I was the only woman out of 300 students. It was great. And we did some demographics. You know, how is it that we managed to make it through the pipeline, at least to getting PhDs, when so many other women decided not to continue? And we found a lot of things in common that surprised us. For example, as in my own case, many of us had fathers who were the centers of our universe, and they died when we were young. And, well, that was strange or startling to have that connection. But then we did a little bit of armchair psychology and figured out, well, what it had done is it had taught us all this carpe diem lesson, right? Mm-hmm. Grab the opportunities because they might not be there tomorrow. Most of us learn that lesson a lot later in life. This was a painful way to learn it early, and it had a big impact. So we were all more adventurous and willing to take risks and grab onto opportunities that came our way. Lots of other things, like more than half of us were either cheerleaders or drum majorettes in high school. I don't know what they have in the UK, but in the US, this is not usually considered a real scholarly or nerdy kind of occupation. But there were no women's sports teams in the high schools we went to, and we were all competitors. And so what did you compete? What could you compete for? To become a cheerleader. or in my case, a drum majora. So it turns out I'm pretty prototypical of women my age who ended up going into male-dominated fields.
Being a female in science is pretty tough. And I mean, in recent times, there's a lot more proactive things happening to do with women in science. There's a lot of kind of support groups in the different departments in the universities. There's lots of the big organisations like Institute of Physics or I3E, which is the engineering one. They've all got women in engineering stuff happening to try and put it out there that, like, you just because you're a woman, it doesn't mean that you can't go into science.
I asked Jill Tarter, because her career goes back quite a long way, whether she'd noticed a change in attitudes.
Yeah, well, you're asking that question at a very timely juncture. We've just had a really difficult month in terms of sexual harassment and women in the field of astronomy. So Google Jeff Marcy, UC Berkeley, and sexual harassment. The only good thing about it is that hopefully now young women who have been troubled by this kind of activity realize that they're not alone and will in fact go through the rather arduous process of making formal complaints, and hopefully their universities will understand that they can't get away with light treatment or no consequences for the offenders if these allegations are found to be valid. So the American Astronomical Society has for a few years now had a committee that very seriously looks at this, and although it's been very painful, may in fact make things better. One of the things that I like best about SETI and being out there to be a cheerleader for this whole enterprise is the fact that if I can talk to an audience for a little while and get them to sort of step back and take this more cosmic perspective, you know, the view from 35,000 feet, seeing themselves in a larger context, seeing themselves as all Earthlings, trivializes the difference among humans that we find so difficult to deal with today. We have all these challenges that don't respect national borders. And if we can get people thinking about SETI, hopefully even supporting SETI and participating in SETI, then we get them primed to participate in other activities that help us to manage some of these challenges around climate change and hunger and poverty. Caleb Scharf, who's the chair of the astrobiology department in Columbia University, wrote a book recently. And there's a wonderful quote in it: on a world with finite resources, a cosmic perspective is a requirement, not a luxury. And it's a really powerful way to think about who we are and what we need to do. If I weren't doing what I am doing or was doing, the technology involved with making a movie is just amazing. It's really, really complicated and fascinating. It was wonderful. I got to talk with Jodie Foster about the character and the role. And before they started filming, we'd have quite long phone conversations, and it would be not about the fine points of radio astronomy and observing or any kind of astrophysical discussions, although Carl did routinely have those with the cast.
Okay.
Jodie wanted to know things like, do astronomers have egos? I said, we're all fine except the infrared astronomers. But it was all about, for her, it was all about not teaching anyone astronomy, but trying to portray the main character as being a human with incredible passions and stubbornness and curiosity, and trying to make the role into something that would appeal to young people and to motivate them, inspire them to go into science. And I think it did that very well. I thought that Jodie Foster did a really good job. She's quite brilliant. She's a very smart lady and actually turns out to be quite kind. I would get these handwritten thank you notes from her while she was sitting in her trailer in Socorro waiting for the rains to stop as they were filming. I also enjoyed the fact that she spent a lot of time standing on a box because Matthew McConaughey is pretty tall. So when they needed the close-up and they needed the two heads on the same level, she'd be on a box. And when I was in Puerto Rico when they were filming at the Arecibo Observatory, I had a great opportunity to take Jodie up into the Gregorian Dome at that radio telescope. And inside, I pointed out to her that it was like the Whispering Dome in, is it St. Paul's Cathedral in London?
Mm-hmm.
Right. For an astronomer, this is our cathedral. We get to view the universe from here, and it is an awesome and powerful place.
Yeah, so the first time I watched Contact was when I was at school, and we watched it as part of our religious studies classes.
Really?
Because of the, you know, you've got the Matthew McConaughey character, who's the religious side of things, and then you've got, obviously, the Jodie Foster character being the science, and just how they interact and influence each other, or not.
That's another aspect of the film that I've always loved, because it's not something you see in many science fiction films. You get to the point, generally, in, you know, Star Trek or something. The Enterprise is generally, you know, very humanistic. It's like humanity can strive and do whatever it wants to if it sets its mind to it. And you come across some spiritual races every now and then. But more often than not, religion's not a part of science fiction. And whether you like it or not here on Earth, a large portion of the population are very religious. And that's a key aspect that comes up in Contact and plays a massive part of it. And it's always been something that fascinates me, especially considering Sagan was an atheist.
Mm. Obviously, there's an awful lot of Sagan in the film.
Yeah.
And an awful lot of Sagan was about, yeah, okay, I'm an atheist. Yeah, okay, I'm a scientist. But science is there for everybody. This is, space isn't for atheists or for religious people. It's for absolutely everybody.
Right at the end of the movie, Jodie and Matthew hold hands. It's like science and religion coming together.
Can faith and science do that? And I can't see why they can't. There are plenty of religious scientists. The scene that always stuck with me in the film is where she has her interview to be the candidate that makes first contact, and they ask her if she believes in God, and she goes, no, as a scientist I don't, and, you know, why should we send someone who doesn't believe what, you know, 95% of the population do? And then Tom Skerritt, you know, essentially plays to the crowd, says he, of course, he believes in God, and, you know, gets sent. I mean, I don't know if it's a Sagan statement on America, but it's the person that believes in God gets the top job. The scene that stands out to me is when they're having the meeting in the White House, and Rob Lowe appears as the head of a conservative think tank, and they're debating whether to build the machine or not. And his key argument is, well, we don't even know if these aliens believe in God or not. As if that's the sole thing we should be thinking about, not whether extraterrestrial life exists. It's like, these aliens could be heathens. But then you have the moderate figure of Palmer Joss, who everything he says, you sit there and go, yeah, I get it.
Yeah,
I get where your faith comes from. And he's open-minded. He's completely open-minded. He loves science, otherwise he wouldn't be there when they meet at the beginning at the observatory. Or what's it? He's investigating whether science killed God.
Yeah.
But he's still open to it. He just wants to explore.
When I was first looking at this SETI and everything and astronomy, I felt like it was reaffirming my lack of belief in any gods at all. But there's a line in the book which is, each of them saw the message as a mirror to their own beliefs, evidence of a god or many gods or none. And that's something that I think we see. I'm going to say this sentence. The astronauts that I've spoken to. It's a fun sentence to say.
Plural?
Yeah.
These are the kind of circles that I've
mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a very common theme amongst astronauts that going out into space and looking at the Earth from space just reaffirms whatever it is you already believe.
A book I remember reading in my teenage years was Michael Crichton's Sphere. And that deals with the first contact situation. There's a great scene in it where they're discussing, you know, what could be in the Sphere or aliens. And I've forgotten the character's name. He's the Ian Malcolm of Sphere. He's just talking about, you're just assuming that this alien's going to even be in three dimensions. What if it's a fourth dimension? What if it's just a really advanced virus? And to my teenage brain, it was like, what? It's not even going to be on two legs. It could just be a virus or something that doesn't even live in this dimension. So if you were sending a representative to deal with alien life, I think what Ellie says in the film, the only true language is math. You would send someone that's really good at math and then, you know, build from there. You've got to be able to communicate first before you start confusing them with things like religion and how at the moment on Earth we're all still fighting over who imaginary friend is the best.
What happens if we meet these extraterrestrials and it turns out they believe in one of the gods that we've come up with here on Earth as well?
They're still worshipping Ra.
Yeah.
They're like, you had it at Ra.
Yeah, exactly.
That was great.
Or it turns out Thursday is the most important day of the week.
Yeah.
Because of Thor.
They're like, we also eat fish on a Friday. You had that bit completely right. Everything else is wrong.
Yeah.
Let's bring it back to Star Trek here.
Okay, let's do that.
While we're doing it. First Contact, another First Contact movie. When they go back to the point of where mankind meets aliens for the first time, it's after World War III, and Deanna Troi tells Zefram Cochrane, the creator of Star Trek, that meeting alien life brings humanity together in a way that no one thought possible, and they wipe out famine and war within 30 years. That is so optimistic. I don't think there is any event in the course of human history that would divide us more than, especially if they're peaceful. If they can't land and they're peaceful, oh my God, there's going to be so much distrust. Think of the migrant crisis that's going on here. It's like, what are these people here for? What are they doing? They're just going to infiltrate us and kill us all. The only possible thing about a first contact with an alien race that's going to unite us is if they're all here to kill us. An Independence Day situation. Only then will we, as a race, kind of unite and go, you know what? You think our problems were bad? These people are here to kill us all. Let's just put aside our petty differences and, you know, hack into their mainframe.
One of the things that Robert Zemeckis is really good at is the special effects that you don't notice. An example of that is when you have the young Ellie Arroway, played by Jenna Malone, and they CG'd her eyes so that they matched Jodie Foster's eyes.
Was that CG? They didn't use colour contact lenses?
Yeah.
Wow, hey, that's amazing. Awesome.
The thing I love about Contact is the pure wonder and majesty that it sets from its very opening scene, with that amazing shot of it just pulling back from Earth and then going back through the solar system and then back through cloud nebulas and then out through the Milky Way, and then you see the other galaxies, and then keeps going further and further back into Ellie's eyes. And yeah, I think I was sold on that film the first moment I saw it. I have some stats about the opening 3.5 minute shot. And that it took 117,000 hours of computer CPU time to render the CGI. The servers crashed more than 25 times while they were doing it. And the shortest amount of time required to render one frame of the CGI was 12 seconds. But the longest time was 18.4 hours. And at the time, it was the longest continuous CGI effect shot until Roland Emmerich made The Day After Tomorrow. And the entire opening scene of where it's panning across the Antarctic to Dennis Quaid's research base, that's all CGI.
Wow.
So, no. Until then, yeah.
Whoa.
I was shocked when I read that. Yeah. So until then, yeah, Contact held the record for doing the longest continuous CGI shot, but it's stunning.
There's everything from wide sweeping shots of New Mexico. Different telescope array to the one in the books?
Yes.
They use the very originally named Very Large Array in New Mexico in the books. And the reason they use an array of telescopes, which these are radio telescopes, they look like giant satellite dishes, is because you can use them as if they were one giant telescope and see smaller things and further away things.
I asked Jill Tarter, what is a typical day at SETI? Is there a typical day at SETI?
Not as glamorous and sexy as you'd think, because we have spent a great deal of time teaching our computers how to do this search. We spend our time looking at data output, looking at screens, writing papers, looking for funding. That's a big challenge for us. Talking with students and trying to figure out what we could do to do the search better. And it's only those signals where the machine has automatically run through a cycle of five different follow-up tests that humans actually get alerted. And that doesn't happen very, very often. It's happened, well, only I think once back in 1997. It was clearly an artificial or engineered signal. It didn't occur just at one frequency. It occurred at a whole lot of frequencies. That's not Mother Nature. And everybody was getting really excited until we realized, as the source was setting, that its frequency was indeed changing in time, but changing in a way that indicated that the source of the signal was actually rising up to the zenith, not setting on the western horizon. And so we left the observatory knowing that this wasn't it. We didn't yet know what it was. It took a bunch of internet research that evening to find out that it was the SOHO spacecraft in orbit around the sun. The fact that it was orbiting the sun is what fooled us. Now, it was a really good dry run.
Yeah, sure.
For what it might be like, including you get so excited you do stupid things.
Yeah.
Including there's no way to keep a secret. Although we have pretty well-defined protocols, it's going to leak.
One of the things I think must have changed SETI quite a bit was Kepler finding all these exoplanets.
Yes, Kepler has been phenomenal. Back when we started SETI, we didn't know whether there were any other planets around any other stars. And today, thanks to Kepler, we know that almost every star has a planet. And probably one in five has a planet in what we would call the habitable zone, which is the right distance from its star so that if there were an atmosphere enveloping that planet, you could expect liquid water on the surface. And liquid water is, we kind of love that for life, although it's life as we know it. Maybe life as we don't yet know it doesn't need liquid water, but we do. And so this idea of a Goldilocks planet, one that's not too hot and not too cold, certainly has a lot of appeal. We are in the process of retooling our observational strategy, and we're going to refocus on the nearest stars. It turns out, in general, those stars are red dwarfs. They're much smaller than the sun, and we've had a long-running debate about whether that's a good place or a bad place for life. But we're just going to take a look.
Brings us quite nicely on to some research and some theories in that area. The most famous one being the Drake equation, developed by Frank Drake.
And it seems fairly out there in terms of science, because it's an equation by which we can work out how many intelligent civilizations are out there in space. So, Steve, can you talk us through it a bit?
Okay, I think maybe we should write it out in the doobly-doop underneath the podcast for reference.
But we'll put it in the notes.
I'm going to go through it. This is a fairly simple equation, which just involves multiplying a number of different variables to give us the predicted number of civilizations in the universe who are actively communicating in a way that we can detect. N is the number of civilizations that we should be able to detect. And then there are a number of factors. There's an R, four Fs, an N and an L that you multiply out to get N. So R is the rate of star formation, number of stars per year that are formed in the universe. FP is the fraction of stars that have planets. NE is the number of planets around that star that could have could be habitable for life. FL is the fraction of those that actually do have life. FI is the fraction of those that go on to develop intelligent life. And then times it by FC, which is the fraction of those intelligent civilizations who develop communications that we can detect. And L is the length of time that those civilizations might be producing detectable signals.
Great.
Now, it's fairly simple. It's just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 numbers multiplied together. The problem with it is that pretty much all of those numbers have very large error bars or have to just be plucked out of thin air.
Absolutely.
So yeah. to speak.
Precise equation.
It's a precise equation with very approximate numbers. And it's very sensible. It's not out there. The logic behind it makes sense. When you put vaguely sensible numbers into that, you get an N of something between some and loads.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So there should be, given the length of time that the universe has been around and the length of time that we have been around, there should be some sort of overlap there, and we should be able to see something. Which brings us on to the next very exciting life in the universe theory, which is
Fermi paradox.
And the Fermi paradox is, given that, why can't we hear anybody?
So I think it's towards the end of the equation that it gets quite interesting. There's intelligent life on this planet that we can't communicate with. Dolphins, you would say, were pretty intelligent. I mean, some scientists are trying to work out how we can talk to them, but it's, you know, we can't talk to them yet. Gorillas are pretty intelligent. Whales are fairly intelligent. Cows are quite intelligent. Dogs are quite intelligent. We couldn't communicate with that kind of life when we're on the same planet as it. So there could be life as complex as spiders, octopuses, on other planets in fairly close proximity, and we wouldn't be able to tell. So the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, as SETI, is looking for a very specific type of intelligence. It's a type of intelligence that is producing radio signals that we can pick up in a wavelength that we're looking at.
Purely because that's the only communication that we know of that can travel those sorts of distances and still be detectable.
So isn't that the answer to the Fermi paradox? It's just vanishingly unlikely that we'll be able to pick up a signal from them.
That's one possible answer to the Fermi paradox. The basic points that Fermi and his collaborator Hart made were that the Sun is a typical star. There's lots of stars like it. It's pretty much in the middle of the range of stars you can get. There are billions of stars in the galaxy that are billions of years older than the Sun. We think the Sun's a third generation star. And there is a reasonable probability that some of these stars will have Earth-like planets. And if the Earth is typical, some of those planets might develop intelligent life. Some of those civilizations might develop interstellar travel. It's something that we're thinking about at the moment. Give it another million years, maybe we'll have it. And even at the slow pace of currently envisioned sub-light speed interstellar travel, the Milky Way galaxy could be traversed in about a million years. So according to this line of thinking, the Earth should already have been visited by extraterrestrial aliens. But Fermi saw no convincing evidence of this. I guess he was doing it at a time when there were lots of reports of UFOs. Nor any other signs of alien intelligence in the observable universe. So his question was, where is everybody?
Maybe they came before we'd evolved.
Yeah, entirely possible, but they haven't left any evidence.
Yes, they have. The Nazca lines.
Big place Scientologists. Anyway, so there are some boring and some scary possible explanations for the Fermi paradox. Number one, no other civilizations have arisen. We're very fortunate, and through this fractional probability, we are the only intelligent life in the universe. Number two is, it's the nature of intelligent life to destroy itself. Now, humanity has come close to that a number of times. The nuclear doomsday clock at certain points in the last century has come very, very close to midnight.
And that was the point of time that Carl Sagan was writing
Cosmos. And who knows what even more effective ways of wiping ourselves out we're going to come up with in the future. Number three, it's the nature of intelligent life to destroy others. So a species that gets to a certain point of technological capability will destroy other intelligent species as they appear, either because it wants to or because it's impact. Or that life is periodically destroyed by naturally occurring events. Next one is something called the inflation hypothesis and the youngness argument, which I won't go into in too much depth because I don't really understand it, but it's about multiverses and maybe most universes are young, so most universes with civilizations will just have one because there hasn't been time. And then there's the fact that intelligent civilizations might just be too far apart, they're not within our observable universe, or they're too far apart in time and we're not overlapping enough. There are more. Earth is deliberately not contacted. This is the prime directive in Star Trek.
We don't have a seat at the table.
We don't have a seat at the table. We're not clever enough yet. We've got to develop warp drives before Spock comes down and says hi.
That's the thing. I've always loved the thought that there is alien life out there and they are just keeping as far away from us as possible. Every now and then they get a little burst of the radio transmissions about what's going on here on Earth and like, oh, dear God. Well, they probably wouldn't say that if they're not religious. But
The most obvious answer to that, to the Fermi paradox to me, is posed in the question, is that there's millions and billions of miles between them. It takes a million years to cross our galaxy. Yeah.
But the flip side to that is there should be civilizations that have been around a lot longer than us and had time to do that. If the dinosaurs hadn't been wiped out as they were, then maybe the dominant species on this planet would be reptilian and they'd have developed clever things millions of years before we have.
But equally, there's one species of all the billions of species on Earth, there's one that's been able to transmit radio signals. So you're asking quite a lot to go from that to interstellar travel to get here. And I just don't think it's a problem. I don't think it suggests anything other than what we already know, which is the universe is big. Really big.
Big is an understatement. Yeah. There's no word to describe the size.
If nothing's out there, it's an awful waste of space.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But it's absolutely all the space you can possibly comprehend. Like, it's crazy.
And more.
Yeah. Mm.
But to be perfectly honest, we probably know an awful lot less about this than Jill Tartans. So I asked her, what was the biggest barrier they have to finding extraterrestrial intelligence?
So I'll give you an analogy, which is numerically fairly accurate. The space that we're exploring for an electromagnetic signal is nine-dimensional. Three dimensions of space, one of time, two polarizations, an unknown modulation scheme. You don't know what frequency to search, and you don't know how sensitive you have to be. I mean, you could guess all the other eight combinations correctly, but you might just not have enough sensitivity because the transmitter might be too far away or not powerful enough. So this nine-dimensional space is pretty daunting.
Yeah.
And if you just said, okay, let's take that total volume that we think we might need to explore to find a signal and set that equal to the volume of the Earth's oceans. Since Frank Drake did the first SETI search back in 1960, how much of that ocean, how much of that search space have we explored? And the answer turns out to be, yeah, about a glass. And it's not because we haven't been working on it.
Yeah.
It's because we haven't yet had the appropriate tools, the tools that are fast enough for this overwhelming search. So the first thing we have to do is filter a little bit of the frequencies that are coming from the telescope. We get to upgrade our servers. We can do that better. As we learn how to look for other types of signals in other ways, we can do that better. And that's been the story of SETI to date. We just haven't had tools that are actually commensurate with this very large search. As we go forward, we may even rethink this ocean, this nine-dimensional space. Maybe we're not looking for the right thing yet. So it's a big, big search. Mm-hmm. But nobody's yet discouraged, even though we've only sampled that one glass. As we know, we're going to get the ability to do it faster tomorrow. SETI started out in the 70s and 80s as a NASA project coming out of the life sciences. That ended in 1993 when Senator Bryan from Nevada terminated, essentially with malice, the funding for SETI. And he told the NASA administration, I'm not only taking it out of this fiscal year's budget, but I don't want to see you come back with this. We turned into the four-letter S word that you couldn't say at NASA anymore. And that's unfortunately true today. So since 1993, the SETI piece of this question of is there life beyond Earth has been funded privately by individuals. Now is the time to be investing in this. We know about exoplanets. We know about extremophiles. And we want to take the next step and figure out whether there are other technologists out there. And this is certainly the time to do it. And the biggest story was that this summer, Yuri Milner, a serial entrepreneur, provided a grant for $100 million over 10 years to the folks at Berkeley. At Berkeley, they are still continuing to run the SETI at Home project, which started a decade ago, that uses your screensaver, essentially, on your computer to analyze data that have been recorded at the Arecibo Observatory and has leveraged the computing power afforded by everybody around the globe who is interested. And in doing so, I think they actually launched this whole field of citizen science.
If any of our listeners have $100 million, then that's great. But if they have a smaller amount of money, can they donate it?
Absolutely. The SETI Institute at SETI.org was very happy to accept donations in any amount. And we'd be delighted to have your listeners become supporters.
Do you have any advice that you would give to young astronomers today?
It's something you really ought to do. You never have to grow up. You never have to stop asking why. And as opposed to any other job that I can think of, you know, you walk in to your office, to your equipment, day or night, whatever, and you're trying to answer questions that you have posed. You're not doing something that somebody else has told you to get done. You're doing it because it's of interest to you. You're curious and you want to know the answer. And you have the opportunity to perhaps be the first person in the world to ever get the answer to that question and understand things in a way that they haven't been understood before. So if you like puzzles, if you like doing your own thing, being curious for the rest of your life, astronomy, engineering, all of it, it's really great.
Fantastic. Thank you very much indeed. It's been an absolute pleasure. And do keep looking.
Thank you, Andrew. We're doing it.
Peggy, who supplies the Cosmic Shed with coffee through the Slow Brew Club. If you're a regular listener to the Cosmic Shed, you'll know is all about taking your time over the coffee. You don't want to scald it. That's not what you want to do. You want to enjoy it. And it's all about taking the time and pausing. So I thought to say thank you to Slow Brew Club and Peggy, we'd ask Jill Tarter what she does when she pauses.
I go dance samba with my husband. Sometimes when I'm observing, but certainly when I'm commuting between Berkeley and Mountain View, I listen to audiobooks. And I also make paisley shirts for my husband. He's a very handsome and slender gentleman with extremely long arms that you can't buy shirts for. And he really fell in love with paisley during the hippie years. Yeah, I try and find time to make paisley shirts for him.
Thank you very much indeed to Ty for joining us here in the Cosmic Shed.
My absolute pleasure. I love this podcast.
Thank you to Steve and Maddie.
Thanks, Andrew.
And if you'd like to hear more from the Cosmic Shed, you can visit thecosmicshed.com.
Or if you're into Twitter, you can follow us at The Cosmic Shed.
Or you can find us on Facebook.
And if you've got a little bit of money that you're not giving to SETI, you could give it to us by visiting patreon.com/thecosmicshed. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.
Will you be my dad?
I am your dad.
No!
Oh, yes, we won't be doing an episode about the next film that we're going to see because next Wednesday night at midnight we are going to see
The Phantom Menace.
Ha 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 ha